Well, thank you very much for having me at this conference in Seattle. It's the first time in this state, so famous for Mount St. Helens and I'm sure other things as well. I've certainly come from a fair way, as you can see from this map here. But if you want to go a bit further, my name is actually a Hebrew name. It's the Hebrew word for Frenchman. So Safety means Frenchman in Hebrew. So I'm ethnically Jewish. I can tell Jewish and French jokes if I want, so I can get away with it. I'm also a chess master. For what it's worth, I even play these little blindfold games like at the this is a creation conference in Australia in 2004 where I played 12 games from memory. So I do a few little things in my spare time. But what I'm talking about here is the amazing issue of designed for life. And it's interesting to talk about what the evolutionists are saying. Look at this quote from Scott Todd. He said, "Even if all the data point to an intelligent designer, such a hypothesis is excluded from science because it's not naturalistic." Now you see the point, he's got a bias there. He is not going to accept a supernatural designer no matter what the facts say. It's a case of don't confuse you with the facts. But of course, as Frank said last time, I mean, science should be the search for true explanations, not naturalistic explanations. Because we can think about the things that we design. We're made in God's image. Part of that image would include creativity. We make things like the jet plane here. Now, how can you tell the jet plane's been designed? Well, one thing, it has oodles of correct components. But you realize that none of the components will fly. You know, a jet plane is made 100% up of non-flying parts. So how do they become a flying machine? Well, the answer is they are organized correctly. Now, when you think of organization, you should think organizer. That's logical. This is real science, what we observe. Organization requires organizer. Now, evolutionists will, on the other hand, say that all you need for organization is a flow of energy through a system. Well, think about that. Bull in a china shop. What happens to that flow of energy through the china shop, okay? But hang on. If you harness the bull to a generator and use the generator to run a potter's wheel, then you could use the energy to make things. See, the difference between harnessed energy by man-made machines, designed machines, and unharnessed energy, which is completely destructive. To give you another example, petrol or gasoline, you call it here, in your car fuel tank, to the fuel line, to the cylinder, where it ignites the chemical energy in the piston, in the cylinder, pushes the piston, and that drives the car. Pour petrol on the outside of the car and light it. What's the difference, okay? Again, one is harness energy, one is unharness energy. And to give you yet another example of energy through a system, we'll think about this thing here, a frog in a blender, and you flick the switch, you're adding energy to the system, aren't you? And what happens? Oopsie, sorry. Let me turn this thing on. Oop. Where is it going? Okay, why is the sound not working? Don't worry about it then, okay. It's meant to have a sound here, but I think you get the idea. What you get is a frog smoothie. Okay, now why did the frog die here? It's because it got disorganized. Yeah. See, all the components are here. So why isn't the frog alive? I mean, because the components are out of sync, aren't they? And if you left this going for millions of years, you think a frog's going to hop out of there again. It doesn't happen that way, does it? No matter what sort of energy you put into the system, no living thing is going to hop out of there again. And that's because every living thing is frightfully complicated. Even the simplest cell is frightfully complicated. If you want to think about a cell compared to a jumbo jet, for instance, jumbo jet has far fewer component parts than any so-called simple cell. I mean, the idea of a simple cell is simplistic. There's no such thing as a simple cell. I mean, think about a cell that has to make copies of itself. I mean, that's incredibly complicated. I mean, how do you make a machine that copies itself? We haven't got one of those. I mean, a photocopier makes copies of documents. It doesn't make copies of another photocopier, does it? I mean, you might have a factory that makes jet planes, but the factory doesn't make another factory. It only makes jet planes. But a cell makes copies of itself. See how much more complicated a cell is than anything that we can make.
But think of other complex things. For instance, we're talking about flying things. Let's think about what natural flying things, like the feathers, for instance. See, feathers are incredibly well designed for flight, light and strong and aerodynamically good. Some evolutionists say they came from scales, but let's have a look at that. Look how different they are. I mean, the feather comes from a follicle like your hair. Feathers are more like hair than scales. The scales just folds in the skin. And think about it. Here's one evolutionist who basically gave up. He said, out of the morphological, which is the shape level, feathers are traditionally considered homologous with reptilian scales. However, in development, morphogenesis, gene structure, protein shape and sequence, filaments formation and structure, feathers are different, i.e. feathers are different in every way. But see, look at how they are. You see, look at the barbs here, and you've even got hooks and ridges, you see, which is why the feather can actually get into shape. You ruffle the feathers, you can still, the bird can preen them back into shape easily because of these natural hooks and barbs there. And that's how the feathers work. Now, the thing is, if reptiles evolved into birds, then where did the feathers come from? Another problem with reptiles into birds is the design of a lung. I mean, our lungs are one marvelous enough. I mean, we went through it last session about how the air comes into these air sacs, and then you've got the blood taking the oxygen out. But the thing is, the bird lung is a completely different sort of lung. You see, the bird lungs have their systems of air sacs here, but the bird lung itself, the systems of air sacs and valves push the air through in one direction through a whole lot of tubes. It's quite a different design. Instead of the bellows-like lung where the air goes in and out in the same, you know, same patches, air in out in the same, the bronchi and the trachea, here the parabronchi, the air is always going in one direction. And the blood is going in the opposite direction. It's called countercurrent exchange. And that's why bird lungs are so good even at high altitudes. They are very efficient at taking up oxygen. But then you have to ask, how could a reptile lung evolve into a bird lung? Well, see, look at what would have to happen. You'd have to have a hernia sort of thing. It's this, this is outgrowth. So the intermediate thing would have a hernia, a diaphragmatic hernia, and therefore they would be at a disadvantage. It would be a lousy sort of lung. So the thing is, natural selection would eliminate these so-called intermediate forms. And the thing is, if a reptile lung couldn't evolve into a bird lung, then a reptile couldn't have evolved into a bird. That's pretty logical. Now, also we've got plenty of other things which are just amazing in design. Now, one thing to think about is the issue of sonars. And guess what? We've got natural sonars. I'd say God made sonars before man thought of them. And in fact, the discovery of bat sonar roughly coincided with the development of man-made sonars. And when this was during the Second World War, the British scientists were worried about leaks and security and all that. They thought when the bat scientists, we were talking about sonar, they'd had a security breach. And they thought it was absurd that these little flying mammals that get in the belfries everywhere has this sophisticated sonar system they'd only just developed. But now we know very well bats have sonars. And in fact, they say bat sonar is so much better than anything developed by human technology, the little creatures seem to enjoy rubbing it in. And you even think that man-made sonar can distinguish echoes 12 minutes of a second apart. That's pretty good. But the bats can go 2 to 3 million. So much closer together the pulses that a bat sonar can distinguish. So bat sonars are better than man-made ones. And they even got other techniques, not just a straightforward matter of emitting a click and timing the echo. They even got what they call sonar strobe groups, so they can target their prey and avoid all the other echoes from the cluster. There's a cluster from all the other things that the echoes are bouncing off, but they can actually focus in on their prey. And then you think of what else the bat sonar can do. It's got volume control. Well, you think about this. Now, as you get closer to a sound source, it becomes louder. And that's one problem. How do the bat control this? In fact, you have to ask, why aren't bats deafened by their own clicks? Such sensitive ears, and you think their own clicks would deafen them. So how do they avoid this? They've got what you call time-varying gain control, like man-made sonars do. The bats thought of it first, which means God thought of it first, really. The bats didn't really think about it, did they? It's their maker who thought of it. See, the thing is, what the bat does is it reduces its hearing sensitivity as it gets closer to the target. And it's because it has a certain muscle, the stapedius, as well, the ear bones, called the stapes or stirrups. And the thing is, it tightens it. You know, like in drums, if you tighten something, you can deaden the beat of the drum. The bat has something like that to deaden the eardrum. So it actually protects it from being deafened by its own sonar pulses. And it's pretty amazing there. They didn't think about this, to have bats ever evolved. Well, think about what we see here. What I've got there is actually the fossil of the oldest known bat according to evolutionary dating. And yet, this evolutionist says the oldest bat fossils unearthed from rocks about 54 million years old, which, of course, I don't believe the dating methods. But the creatures they represent aren't dramatically different from living bats. Interesting, bats have always been bats. Isn't that what the Bible says? Things reproduce after their kind. And what they say here, hallmark features of these creatures include the elongated fingers that support the wing membrane and the extensive coiling of bony structures in the inner ears, a sign that they were capable of detecting the high-frequency chirps and echolocation. So the first bats were capable both of flight and of echolocation. There's no evidence in the fossil record that bats ever evolved from non-bats. But of course, bats aren't the only animal that uses sonar. There's also a type of bird called the oil bird that uses sonar, but the best known one would probably be the dolphin. I mean, a dolphin has been the envy of Navy sonar developers because, for instance, it can detect a fish the size of a golf ball 230 feet away. That's a pretty sensitive little sonar there. And in fact, the Navy scientists looked at the dolphin click pattern and found that they were mathematically designed to give the most accurate information from its surroundings. There's incredible mathematics involved in the dolphin sonar clicks. And they also have what we call the melon, this bulbous structure in the head. That's actually a sound lens. It focuses the clicks into a beam. So it's all these sorts of structures which have to be working all together for the sonar to work, and they're all there. And then you've got the question again, how do dolphins evolve, avoid being deafened by their own pulses? Well, it's different from the way the bat does it. You see, remember what I said, that the bat reduces the sensitivity of its hearing? Well, what the dolphin does, it reduces the intensity of the clicks it emits, you see? So as the dolphin gets closer to the target, it automatically makes the clicks a bit softer. So once again, you've got this automatic control as the dolphin homes in on the target. And here's another thing, again, dolphins did not evolve because they said the ancestor of today's dolphins had an ear structure that suggests they could echolocate as well as their modern relatives can. So again, where's the evidence for the evolution of echolocation? It isn't there. They were always echolocating right from the beginning, just as we'd expect. Now, other things which are amazing in the animal kingdom we've only just been discovering, and for instance, the way things stick to surfaces, lots of different ways. You've got special proteins and the way muscles stick as sort of super glue, amazing chemicals there for muscles. That's the MUSSEL type muscles, the shellfish sticking to surface. It only just discovered its super glue compound, which is an amazing chemistry. But geckos are also well known to be very sticky. They can stick to polished glass on the ceiling. You know what they're like, don't you? And it's only recently we've discovered how the geckos stick because they use something called the van der Waals forces, very small, close-range forces. And to make use of these close-range forces, they have to have very tiny hairs on their feet. And the hairs themselves, as you can see, very, very tiny, and then the hairs are subdivided at the tips, and look at the tips there. Incredibly fine structures. So the people who discovered this said designing such a structure is beyond the limits of technology, human technology. So what does it say about the designer of the gecko? An intelligence far above our own. But in fact, they have eventually managed to copy this design. That they've made sticky tape based on the gecko design. Again, they didn't think of it before they saw the gecko, but now that they've seen the gecko, somehow we can try to emulate what the master did before us. So in fact, they shouldn't get the copyright or the patent for the sticky tape, should they? Because they just copied what was already there. Now, here's another example of where humans are copying what God has put in there before us, and that's in the amazing lobster eye. I mean, if you look at a lobster eye under a magnifying glass, it looks like perfect graph paper, because you look at a bee's eye or an insect eye, you see the very fine hexagons on the surface. But the lobster eye has squares on its side. It's quite a different geometry. How do you evolve from a hexagonal to a square geometry? Because if it's neither hexagonal nor square, it's inefficient. And natural selection would tend to eliminate those things. They're neither good hexagons nor good squares. But the lobster has to be a good hexagon because its eyes work differently from most. Because most eyes, they work by refracting or bending light to a focus. That's how our eyes work. But the lobster eye works by reflecting light to a focus. A completely different method of focusing. And this has inspired the design of an X-ray telescope. Because how do you focus X-ray, which go through things? Well, what you do is you have X-rays bouncing off lead glass at a very shallow angle, and they will tend to bounce. So what they've done is make square glass tubes with lead-enriched glass, and they arrange it into the lobster eye geometry. They call this the lobster eye telescope. So once again, looking at what we have in nature has given human engineers such good ideas. And also to produce parallel X-ray beams for etching very fine patterns, they just run the lobster eye in reverse. You see, the lobster eye works by focusing light from out in a distance and into a focus. If you run it in reverse and you have an X-ray source at the focus, it will produce a parallel beam. So once again, we see what we see in the living world has inspired what human designers are taking up. The field is called biomimetics, you know, mimicking life, in other words. Now, brittle stars is another example of amazing design discovered fairly recently. They found the entire skeleton was one big compound eye. And the lead researcher, Joanna Eisenberg, she says, this study shows how great materials can be formed by nature far beyond current technology. In general, arrays of microlenses are something that technology tried a couple of years ago. Nobody knew that something like that already existed in nature. So once again, the amazing technology of building these crystal arrays is just something which we didn't even have an idea would exist in nature like this, especially a so-called primitive thing like a brittle star. Scientist is also an expert in this sort of area of biomimetics. I don't think she's a creationist, but here she discovered, and the next thing she discovered was the Venus flower basket, a sort of sponge. But it turns out the Venus flower basket is, in fact, superb fiber optics. You think of ordinary fiber optics, they break quite easily. You see, sometimes we're transmitting information by fiber optics instead of by copper. It's actually more efficient and carry more messages per second than fiber optics, but they do break quite easily. And that's the cause of massive outages. But the sponge fiber optics are actually bitten. She says we're in the Stone Age compared to nature. Isn't that something? So nature, in other words, well, I'd say that the creator of nature is so far above us. And if we can learn from nature, there may be an alternative way to manufacture fiber in the future. Because it's also manufactured at low temperature instead of the very red-hot temperatures that we have to use for our own glass fiber. The sponge doesn't need red-hot temperatures. It's in the sea. And the thing is, the sponge's fiber optics are made in very fine concentric layers, and it's this layering that makes them very flexible, because in an ordinary fiber optic, you see, the crack will propagate, but when you have the layers, the different layer boundaries stop the cracks penetrating. So the sponge's optics resist cracks far more than our fiber optics do. Well, let's get back to the idea of the design, and we have things like the accusations of bad design. Now, that's one of the arguments used against the design, but we've got supposedly badly designed things. Well, let's think about this. I'd say we don't have bad design. It's a reflection of our ignorance, because we don't have all the information. Like, for instance, they thought the panda's thumb was a badly designed thing, the adaptation of a of a certain bone, and Stephen Jay Gould wrote about this badly designed. He had a book called The Panda's Thumb. In fact, the panda's thumb is an excellent tool for stripping leaves off bamboo, so it's designed to do what it does. And supposing junk DNA, that concept's about to be junked. We're finding so many uses. I mean, John Mattick from the University of Queensland, where I live in Australia, he thinks it's a part of an advanced operating system. And also, the so-called junk DNA seems to code for the certain RNA molecule, which are essential to operate the immune system. So now the ENCODE program, the research program, is saying that instead of only 3% of our DNA being functional, it's more like 97% being functional, and possibly the entire thing is functional. So this junk DNA has harmed research, because if you think something is junky, you don't bother looking for reasons to have it. But now they're almost certain that there are very good reasons to have junk DNA, supposedly. It shouldn't be called that at all. Or, for instance, the bad back is supposedly a bad design, but in fact, the bad back supposedly is a result of the fall and a result of poor posture. But in fact, the lordosis, which is the inner curvature of our spine, it makes it in fact stronger than a gorilla's spine, weight for weight. A man we called Dr. Richard Porter, we've interviewed him in Creation Magazine, he's on our website. He has published 100 papers on the spine. He knows what he's talking about, and he says that the spine is incredibly well designed to support upright posture. And the appendix, it actually has a very important use in fighting infection, especially in the neonatal stage, you know, because the appendix is the junction of the small and large intestine. It controls the bacteria that get into the colon. It becomes less useful later in life, but the fact that it has lymphatic tissue means that it's part of the immune system, just like the tonsils at the other end of the alimentary canal. I mean, they can get infected, but I think doctors nowadays are trying not to remove the tonsils, if at all possible, because they realize their important role in the immune system. And of course, you've got there may well be some loss of information since the fall. So some of the supposed bad design might be not bad design, but degeneration of a better design. And that's to be expected if we understand the creation and the fall. And that's, I think, a problem with the intelligent design movement. I appreciate a lot of what they do, but the thing is, when they want to leave the Bible out of things, they neglect the history, the real history of not only creation, a perfect creation, but a fall because of the sin of mankind, and also God's judgment in the global flood. See, by neglecting the history of design, they haven't got enough answers. Or you have things like... these are examples of supposed bad design. I'd say what happened, wingless insects on windswept island. What happens? See, if you get swept out to a little island during a storm, what happens when you try and fly up again? You get blown into the sea. But if your descendants have a mutation, a copying mistake which stops the wings forming, they don't fly up and get blown into the sea. So in fact, you might say this is a beneficial mutation being wingless, but it's still a downhill change. They can't fly anymore. It just happens to be an advantage on this particular island. Or, for instance, fish in dark caves with shriveled eyes. I think they did come from fish which could see, but in fact, it's gone downhill. It's not gone uphill. Big difference. You see, if there's no light, there's not much use having eyes. In fact, your eyes might be a disadvantage because they're very sensitive and they could get bruised and infected and become quite lethal. And so if the fish had a mutation which caused the eyes to shrivel up, it might do better in a dark cave where eyes aren't much used anyway. Now, one of the amazing, commonest example is a supposed back of the eye, wide eye. Have you heard of this one? I mean, people like Richard Dawkins and Rick Kenneth Miller, all sorts of evolutions have dined out on this one. For instance, when you look at the structure of the retina, the photoreceptors are here. This is the light-detecting cells that we talked about so much in the last lecture. The light comes from this direction, but the thing is the nerves go in front of the light cell, the light detectors. And see, Richard Dawkins says, any engineer would naturally assume the photocells would point towards the light and the wires would come behind them away from the light and backwards into the brain. He would laugh at any suggestion the photocells might point away from a light with their wires departing on the side nearest the light. But this is exactly what happens in all vertebrate retinas. Each photocell is in effect wired and backwards with its wire sticking out on the side nearest the light. And he goes on to say the wire has to travel over the surface of the retina to a point where it dies through the hole in the retina, the so-called blind spot, to join the optic nerve. And that means the light, instead of being granted an unrestricted passage to the photocells, has to pass through a forest of connecting wires, presumably suffering from at least some attenuation and distortion. Actually, probably not much, but still the principal thing that would offend a tidy engineer. You know, he's the author of things like The God's Delusion, which is really reflects on Dawkins' own delusions. If you want to see something, look at our website for a refutation of that book. And see, what I'm saying here, though, he doesn't know what he's talking about. And people who do know what they're talking about, real ophthalmologists, have said that you need the eye wired this way because thing is, the photocells are very chemically active. You have to regenerate them after the detected light because there's a chemical structural change. And the thing is, if the eye was wired Dawkins' way, we'd be blinded for a month before when we have a flash of light. So his idea of design, it really shows an ignorance of eye anatomy, because what we have here behind the photocell is this huge, rich blood supply, the choroid. It's a whole lot of blood. In fact, there's more blood than there is vessel in the choroid. That's how rich it is. And the thing is, that is why we can adjust so easily after a flash of light. We get a very temporary dazzlement, but we recover quite quickly because we've got this blood supply to regenerate the photocells. And also, they've done experiments on dead animal eyes, and they find the light will actually burn. Why doesn't it do it in living animals? Because the blood also carries away the excess heat and prevents a burn. The thing is, you've got to put the blood somewhere, and it's best to put the blood behind the photocells. If you put the blood in front, of course, blood in front of your retina is blinding. When you think of the hemorrhages in your eye, it's a terrible thing to happen. It just blocks out all the light. You can't have the blood here. You've got to have it behind, which means you have to have the nerves in front to leave room for the blood. So, in fact, the eye has to be wired this way, otherwise it wouldn't work. Okay, so really Dawkins and Miller and all these people, they should really do a course in ophthalmology and learn what they're talking about. But, in fact, only a couple of months ago, Dawkins would be even further blown away by the discovery that we actually have a fiber optic plate. The Müller cells in the eye, they are actually optical fibers. And what the optical fibers do is they guide the light through the nerve network to the photocells. In fact, there isn't any distortion. In fact, they say it's reminiscent of the fiber optic plates used for low distortion image transfer. So, in fact, the eye is designed absolutely correctly, and it also has this fiber optic plate to avoid the disadvantage of the nerves being in front, because the light doesn't have to go through the nerves, it's guided through them. And you see how it's even better than our fiber optic, because it has a funnel at the end, so it actually picks up more light that way. The entire surface of the retina actually has the Müller cells funneling as much light as possible to the nerves, the receptors at the back, and as Frank told you, the rods can detect a single photon of light. You can't improve on that sensitivity, because a single photon is the minimum amount of light you have. So the idea that it's a badly designed thing is just a complete nonsense. It also refutes one of Dawkins' main arguments for evolution, because you think he does, in his books, he has this idea that the eye came because you have this network of photocells, and then the thing is, what he says happened, it formed a little cup, and that means it has some directionality, because this cup means that light coming from here won't hit this one, it's shielded, so you can tell which direction the light's coming from if you have a cup, and you keep on cupping to improve a directionality, then it it folds over. But what he's neglecting to show is the nerves, you see, because he starts off with the nerves behind, and then he does a little conjuring tricks and puts the nerves in front, you see. In fact, he doesn't explain how the nerves got from behind the photocells to becoming in front. You see, that's what I call a blind spot in Dawkins' own evolutionary ideas. Now, another amazing thing we have in living things are these, we actually have real electrical motors in the living world. I mean, a famous evolutionist called J.B.S. Haldane from Britain in the first half of the century said, evolution, you would not expect to find wheels or magnets in living things because natural selection couldn't build them because they have to be pretty much perfect before they work at all. But now we know we actually do have motors. Sorry. You see, this is actually a real electrical motor. This is the germs in your gut, for instance, I'm sorry to say. The E. coli in the gut have these motors. See, it's turning about 100,000 revs per minute. And it's so efficient, it can change direction. In a quarter of a turn, it can stop and reverse. And it's got a universal joint to change the rotary motor into a wave-like motor. This is a motor so tiny that you need an electron microscope to see it. This is what we call nanotechnology, incredibly small machinery here. And in fact, not only is the machinery amazing, but so is the assembly mechanism. It has to be pre-programmed, showing you how the flagellum actually assembled itself. It's got this pre-programmed, it's a program to assemble the different components in all the right order, as we're seeing here. And it's just amazing to see how this could have evolved by time and chance. Now, certain people have said the flagellum has evolved from what they call what plague germs have. They have a device to secrete toxins into the organism they're plagiarizing. It's called a type 3 secretory apparatus. But that's not true, because a man called Scott Minnick from Idaho, he is a world expert on the flagellum, and he said it had to have been the other way around. The secretory apparatus must have devolved from the flagellum, because you think of that assembly machinery I was showing you, it pumps out the proteins in a very precise order, but when this assembly is disrupted, it will start pumping proteins out more haphazardly. Okay, so it had to be the other way around. In fact, the plague germ only starts to degenerate into the secretory thing when it gets above 37 degrees, which is about our body temperature, okay? 37 Celsius, okay? That's what we use in the rest of the world, sorry to say. So that's why the evolutionists have got the Dawkins and Miller have got it around the wrong way. And in fact, even the evolutionary experts on the system disagree with Miller and Dawkins, because here's one example. It seems plausible that the original type 3 secretion system for virulence factors evolved from those of the flagellar assembly. So even the evolutionists, who have they're not creation, they say it must have happened the opposite way from Richard Dawkins. But then there's the problem, where did the flagellum come from in the first place? They haven't solved it after all. Because the explanation that Miller uses is back to front. And here's another researchers who say the same thing. The flagellar apparatus was the precursor of type 3 protein. So really, again, these evolutions are out of step with their experts from their own camp. I mean, why are they given so much credibility by these judges like this former liquor board chairman, Jones, who ruled in the Godova creation trial, who is not qualified in science, but he just believed the sort of nonsense that Dawkins and Miller told him. And it's pretty logical when you think about it, because according to evolutionary theory, there must have always been liquids for germs to swim in, but there haven't always been complex organisms for them to parasitize. So even logically, the swimming thing had to come before parasite implement. Because, for instance, even like the jellyfish stinging cells have the same problem, because jellyfish are supposed to evolve before there's anything for it to sting. So again, the evolutionary order of things just doesn't match up with what we're seeing, though, which means that it didn't really evolve at all. But the amazing thing here is also not just the machinery I showed you, but it's actually the blueprint, as it were, of the machinery is in this molecule called DNA, not National Dyslexia Association, okay? Deoxyribonucleic acid. And this is actually a chemical message molecule, a very complex molecule and a very unstable one, too. It's just not the sort of molecule you could get in a primordial soup. It just wouldn't work. It's too unstable. In fact, RNA is more unstable than DNA. And yet people are talking about the RNA world, but really it doesn't make any sense because RNA just wouldn't form in a primordial soup. And if it did form, it would break down. But what we have with DNA is actually a message molecule that actually codes for all what I've shown you. It's coded in this molecule called DNA, a sequence of four types of chemical letters. Now, to explain the information, you have to understand that the information in your books is not the ink molecules on the paper. It's the way they are arranged. For instance, I could have the same information in your book as on a piece of string, like, for instance, a double knot for a dash, a single knot for a dot. You use Morse code, you get the Bible on a piece of string, and you could read it in the dark. The same information, different means of storing it. I mean, on my computer, the information is in the form of on and off magnetic patterns on my hard drive. So same information, different medium. Now, DNA has a different medium. It's four different types of chemical letters, and they're read in groups of three. Every three DNA letters codes for one protein letter. And there are actually other codes. There's a codes upon code as well. But what I'm talking about now is just the code for the protein. Just every three letters codes for one protein letter. And that's how we get all the things that we see, because of the way the DNA codes for it. But there's also other things which control how the code is read. Now, there's an amazing amount of messages on the DNA. You know, every human cell in your nucleus has 3 gigabytes worth of information. That's in the cell nucleus. You need a microscope to see the cell nucleus. That's how much information it has. It's the equivalent of 1,000 books worth of information. So it's a huge amount of information in each of our cells. And when we see the message, whenever we see a message, we should think there's a messenger there. Isn't that logical? And yet there's oodles of messengers in the DNA. Now you think about the SETI program. They're looking for signals from outer space which have messages on them, have some sort of like a sequence of prime numbers. Now, if they saw that, they'd say, well, there's proof positive. There's a message sender out there. Okay, they're spending billions of dollars of taxpayers' money on this silly SETI project. Yeah, they won't look down the electron microscopes and see, well, look at the messages on the DNA. And look for, well, who's the messenger behind those. Now, DNA is also the most compact information storage system we have. I mean, for instance, if you think of a pinhead of DNA, the amount of paperback that could be stored on this pinhead of DNA would be a pile of paperback books from here to the moon 500 times. Or take my hard drive here. It's a reasonably good hard drive, 40 gigabytes, but a pinhead of DNA is 100 million times better than my hard drive, as far as the amount of information it can store. So it's amazing. It's got the best, the most compact information storage system in the universe. But the thing is, my hard drive is not much use unless I've got a message on it. There's a difference between a hard drive with programs and data on it than a blank hard drive. But guess what? You can't weigh that difference. Information is something you can't weigh, but the difference is definitely there, isn't it? But the thing is, like a book and a hard drive, a message is no use unless you can read it. I mean, for instance, I can read my books, for instance, the letters C-A-T mean this animal that has retractable claws and leaves fur over your furniture. No need for that. There's no relation of C-A-T to that animal. That's because it's got a language convention. Now, a language convention requires intelligence. For instance, G-I-F-T in English means present, but in German means a poison. So German postal workers that weren't happy handling packages marked gift. So you write message wrong reading. And the thing is, the DNA requires the right code. And this code is read in this complex machine called the ribosome. Now the problem with that though is the instructions to build the ribosome are on the DNA. So can you see the big chicken and egg problem here we have? We can't read the instructions of the DNA without the ribosome. We can't build a ribosome unless we have the DNA instructions to build it. So the thing is, you need them both together. Otherwise, it just won't work. Now, the important thing about the DNA information is to contrast real real science, real information with what the evolutionists claim. They claim, for instance, that we have an evolutionary tree where we have, say, a primordial soup. I mean, no one's ever proved that a primordial soup ever existed on this planet, but they believe it anyway. That's because it's part of their belief system. And they say that a primordial soup, somehow all the chemicals arose, evolved, all the letters of the DNA or RNA evolved. And the thing is, like alphabet soup, you can imagine the letters of alphabet soup arising, but I think if you saw it spell out your name and I love you, you'd know that it didn't happen by the swirling of the soup, did it? It would have happened because someone organized it. So having the letters is one thing, but having the letters in some sort of sequence is quite another. And even the simplest cell would have to have about 600,000 letters arranged in the right way. And in fact, that's a conservative estimate. It's probably going to be much bigger than that. And the thing is, from this primordial soup with zero information, you have this simple cell with over 500,000 letters. And then from a simple cell, you have all the different plants and animals, including man with 3 billion letters worth of information. You see, this is called from goo to you via the zoo. Now, let's look at this in some detail and see what really happens. Like, I'm going to give you a lesson in genetics here. I mean, not very hard. Just to point out, we have our information in pairs. You get one half from your mum, one half from your dad. And when you marry and have kids, you pass on one half, your spouse passes on the other half. And what I've got here are these two doggies here. This says make short fur, this says make long fur. When you got them both together, you have medium fur. Now, when they marry and have pups, they pass on one or the other, right? So what we have here, this is one possible pup. It's got the short genes from dad here and a short gene from mum, and it's got short fur. Or this one here, we have one of each. And this one here, so you got a long fur gene from this. See, Darwin looked at this. He had no idea of genetics. That was discovered by a creationist called Gregor Mendel. Now, Darwin saw this, and he saw his evolution happening. You got two new varieties happening. But in reality, there's nothing new there. The information was already there in the beginning. All we're seeing is sorting out what was already there. Has nothing to do with the goo to you evolution. Now let's take this a step further and imagine they go through the Ice Age or go to Canada, same thing. What happens in the Ice Age? Who dies? Who survives the Ice Age best? The dogs with the long fur are protected from the cold. The other ones die out. And so what happens in the next generation? They can only have long furred animals. And That's what we see here, and this is actually natural selection going on. Now, note, natural selection is not evolution. So what we're seeing here is the loss of genes for short fur. So in fact, the natural selection removes information. It's the opposite of evolution, which is supposed to be about how information goes uphill. Okay, so what happens if the climate warms up? These poor dogs will overheat. They've got no information for short fur anymore. See, so dogs are changing, but they're changing into other dogs. That doesn't do you much good for evolution, does it? There's one more thing, that's what Frank mentioned, the mutation, which is a typo in the information, like this one here. Now, we might breed animals like that, but it's still the poor animal, because face hasn't developed properly. And you get this one here, your TNR mutant, a totally naked rooster. Now, Colonel Sanders would love this one because he doesn't have to pluck it. But the poor rooster fries in summer and freezes in winter because he's got no feather mutation here. No feather development. And the thing is, experts on information say all point mutations that have been studied on a molecular level turn out to reduce the genetic information and not increase it. See, here's the problem. See, evolution, this goo to you picture, requires information to go uphill. Now, what we're seeing here is, this one here where we've got sorting out information that's already there, or we see loss of information because natural selection is weeding out part of it, or we see mutations that corrupt information. We're not seeing information going uphill to build any of these machines I've talked about. Let's see if this slide works. Here's an interview with Professor Richard Dawkins here. He says...
genetic mutation or an evolutionary process which can be seen to increase the information in the genome.
They seem to be, don't they? But this is the video frog to a prince here, and you can see he didn't answer the question. He went and answered a completely different question. He just couldn't answer this. He's also said amazing things like, evolution has been observed. It's just that it hasn't been observed while it's happening. Now, the last thing I want to talk about briefly is, in fact, the amazing example of desires, in fact, any life at all. So the origin of first life, you see, the complexity of the cell is mind-boggling. You see, Michael Denton is not a creationist. He said, to grasp the reality of life as it has been revealed by molecular biology, we must magnify a cell 1,000 million times till it's 20 kilometers in diameter and resembles a giant airship. Large enough to cover a great city. What we will see then is an object of unparalleled complexity and adaptive design. That D word again, we would find ourselves in a world of supreme technology and bewildering complexity. This is a simple cell, supposedly. And the thing is, you can't use natural selection to explain the origin of first life, because natural selection requires things which are already reproducing, and some things reproduce better than other things. But if you haven't got self-reproduction, you can't have natural selection. It just doesn't make any sense. I mean, it's like talking about a race between two runners, and they're both dead on the starting line. So you only have chance to explain the living cell. And for instance, one of the things discovered since Denton wrote, with this amazing molecular motor. It's in each of your cells. This is a motor that produces the energy currency of life. This is so tiny that 100 trillion could fit into a pinhead. And it's making a molecule called ATP, which you need for life. Just like gasoline you need for a car. If you haven't got gasoline, your car's dead. If you haven't got ATP, you're dead. That's why cyanide works. Cyanide stops ATP being produced, and that's why death follows really quickly from cyanide poisoning, because you do need this molecule, ATP. In fact, your body makes and consumes about half its weight in ATP every day. That's how important this motor is. And this motor was only discovered in about 10 years ago, and a Nobel Prize was awarded for discovering this motor. That's how amazing it is. About 10,000 reps per minute, that's how fast it goes. Every rotation produces 3 of these ATP molecules. Now, once again, you hardly hear a peep out of how this thing could have evolved, because you need this motor before life can even exist, because you need the ATP for energy. Now, some have said this might have evolved from some components of another thing called a helicase. But the real problem is, first of all, how is not enough to have the components of a motor, you have to get them in the right order. I mean, an electrical shop might have all the components there, but a bomb in that shop, you're not going to make a motor by throwing them together, are you? You have to organize them in the right way. But another problem with the idea evolved from helicase is that helicase requires ATP to work. So this motor had to come first. Because I believe they were created all at once. But the thing is, even logically, you have to have the ATP motor before you can have a helicase, which makes use of ATP. So once again, there's such amazing examples of design, even in the so-called simple cell. And if you want to see more about it, there's a video of mine called From Chemicals to Living Cell, Fantasy or Science. And here's another, just to leave you with this thought before I mention some of the books and videos we have, is what happens if they manage to create life from the test tube? Will that disprove God? Think about this. If I can just synthesize life here, then I'll have proven that no intelligence was necessary to form life in the beginning. Now, as I said, we said in the beginning, this is a good place to stop the actual talk, but I want to say that I come from Creation Ministries International. We are the producers of Creation Magazine, which, by the way, is our answer to Time and National Geographic. Why should the devil have all the best magazines which promote God hatred, basically?
We have Creation magazine to answer these people. And this comes out, it still comes out, it never stopped, by the way. I'm not sure what you may have heard from some quarters. The Creation magazine has always been published, and we can give you a chance to subscribe to it. It has no paid advertising, comes out four times a year, 56 pages, full of information to help you fight back and to share with friends. It's been our number one witnessing tool. I mean, people have come to the Lord through this. We've got hundreds of testimonies on file. And in that display area, there's a form. That's where the door is called Fossil. There are amazing fossils there. A great collection there. That's a good enough reason to go to that room. But if you go there, you'll find there are the sign-up forms for Creation magazine, as well as an email newsletter, which will tell you about our website, which is called creationontheweb.com, which has over 5,000 articles. Every day it's updated. So you see there's a new article in the newspapers which says evolution's true, the Bible's wrong. We'll have an answer to that in a few days. So this is the way to refute the propaganda in the evolutionary marketplace. So creationontheweb.com is our website, and there's also on the tables is a place you can sign up for a free newsletter. You can unsubscribe from if you want to, if you get sick of it. But this sort of gives you an idea of what's coming out. In fact, one of my books is coming out this year on design, which will go into a lot more detail than I can do in a talk. So we'll keep you informed. And also some books I've written already, Refuting Evolution. It's sold 500,000 copies now, which I think is actually the best-selling creationist book around that's been written, as far as I've been told. I get no royalties from them, by the way. So it goes to the ministry, any money that comes. And also, this refutes evolution in the classroom, the university. This book refutes evolution in the media, like the Scientific American, like the PBS Evolution series, a 10-part series in 2001. Remember that? Well, this goes through it point by point. And the third one refutes evolution in the church, about people like Hugh Ross who want to add millions of years to the Bible. And that's what I'll be talking about tomorrow, by the way, in a bit of detail about the compromise. That's tomorrow morning, so I hope to see you there. And you can get all three of these for $28, and that's a real Jewish bargain, and I should know. So I guess it's time to hand back to the boss who's organized this wonderful conference, Chris. So thanks very much for having me here.
I think we have time for a couple of questions, if you don't mind.
Please.
Just a couple, and I'll bring you the mic if anyone has one. After the fall, when I believe everything, except I'm confused and know there must be, if I don't know the answer, I know there must be there somewhere, we just may not know it, but how do you explain how all the animals transformed from vegetarian, mode into all the tooth and claw, physical behaviors and structures that eat meat and kill each other?
Okay, the question is about how originally animals were created vegetarian. Now, Genesis 1, 29 and 30 says that everything was vegetarian. They ate the herbs, okay? Now, my book, Refuting Compromise, goes into some ideas about how this could have happened. Like, for one thing, we can see even nowadays so-called meat-eating animals like lions, which exist entirely on vegetables. We've got an article coming up in our Creation magazine about a lion that ate spaghetti, didn't eat meat. Another lioness lived a whole life without eating meat. In fact, in Indonesia, dogs, meat's so expensive that they feed their dogs vegetables. So it can be done. And we've also conversely found examples of sheep attacking chickens. And I've seen a picture of a cow eating a rabbit. So even though they are traditionally vegetarian animals, they can become meat eaters under certain circumstances. You wonder, after the fall, when God cursed the vegetation, some plants may have been less nutritious, and therefore features that might have been good for plant eating were used for eating animals. And that's certainly a partial answer. In fact, some spiders in Australia have been known to catch pollen on their webs and use it for food. But in fact, nowadays they can't use it completely because the pollen lacks essential nutrients, so they have to supplement that with insects. So you imagine before the fall, they could have used their webs entirely for pollen. There are a few other examples that we've got in my book about how disease germs, it seems that when they degenerate, they become dependent on a host for survival. That's another thing which has happened. And also, since God foreknew the fall didn't take him by surprise. I think some of the features that God had programmed, but it kept them latent. They were hidden and were switched on at the fall. I mean, God is the master programmer. In fact, when you develop from an embryo, things are switched off as you develop. You see, your skin cell has the information to build eyes and bones and muscle and nerves, but only the skin information developed. Everything else is switched off in your skin cell. So why couldn't the master geneticist be able to switch information on and off, knowing that the fall was going to happen, and therefore animals had to be adapted for life in a fallen world? So just Refuting Compromise has a chapter on this sort of thing. Okay?
If the old body you should you see in the news a lot when they're talking about looking for water on Mars or other planetary bodies, and having that having to do with the existence of life on these other planetary bodies. Obviously, water is required to sustain life, just like that. But would water preclude life from developing on its own according to the evolutionary theory? Would it be a neutral element, or would it have, you see what I'm asking? Does that make sense?
I think I do. The point is, there's quite a difference. Water is necessary for life, but it's not sufficient for life. I mean, so it's it that we need water to exist, but as I said, water actually helps to break down the molecule. I'll just show you from chemistry. I've got a slide from the chemistry here. See, when two amino acids, the building blocks of protein, combine, what they do is they eliminate water molecule, okay, and form this peptide bond. That's how proteins form. You keep on doing this. See, it eliminates this water molecule here. But the thing is, this reaction is actually what we call reversible. Okay, continues on both ends. Okay, it keeps on going. That's how you get the proteins forming. But the point is, it goes better in the other direction. Okay, so when you have water added to the system, it tends to push it to breaking up the molecules. In fact, the DNA and RNA will also break up in water. So that when you have water around, you just don't get these molecules, big molecules forming. In fact, as a chemist, I know that when a real chemist wants to make a protein, he excludes water rigorously from the reaction. No chemist in his right mind would have water in the system. He wants to get rid of it. So the idea of water being there just doesn't make any chemical sense. Okay?
One more? You okay? I don't know if you can answer this, but I hope someone can, but I have a billion questions, but, okay, I'm trying to figure out which one is the good one. Can you explain, when the Bible first starts, that there was, in the beginning, there was darkness on the face of the earth, and then the Holy Spirit there. And then also God says that there be light. What is that light?
Yeah. I mean, we can make light without the sun and moon, if that's what you're asking. How could it be light days and nights before the sun and moon were created on day four? Is that the sort of question you're asking? That's part of it. It's Refuting Compromise goes into that. In fact, God doesn't need the sun and moon to create light. We don't need the sun and moon. This is light. I don't need the sun to make light. If I don't need it, God doesn't need it either. And see, the thing is, you can have day and night before the sun, because all you need is a rotating earth, and light from a particular direction, and you've got a day-night cycle before the sun and moon were created. And the sun and moon were created on day four to take over the job of being light-bearers for the earth. But before that, there was a light that God created. And you look in the book of Revelation, right towards the end, it said there will be no sun and moon in the New Jerusalem because the light of a Lamb will provide the light, okay? Well, I mean, okay, light in the sense of electromagnetic radiation, no, I'd say not, because God is spirit, not matter, okay? It's a different dimension, if you like. But certainly, I mean, you can say that God, Jesus is described as the light of the world in John 1, that's quite clear, but I believe that's a metaphor. Because light is something that God created. Jesus is uncreated, pretty clearly. Basically, light can be used, he lights up the world, and yet the darkness did not like the light. That's what it says. So I believe that the light was created by God, but it wasn't God himself necessarily. Okay.